Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. Tonight, I have essayist Bob Brody with me. He's written a book called Playing Catch with Strangers that so took me by surprise that I absolutely had to have him come on the show. I'm going to tell you why in just a minute. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Well, I guess my theme music is stuck. It's decided not to play with me tonight, and that's okay. More time to speak with Bob. So I get hundreds of emails every day from writers and wannabe writers, but this one caught my attention immediately. It was from Mr. Brody, who wrote, "Dear producer, I confess I never cheated on my wife, abused drugs, run with a gang." We're stopping that for right now. I've never run with a gang, attempted suicide, or killed anybody, but that's okay. I've written a memoir anyway. Playing Catch with Strangers, A Family Guy Reluctantly Comes of Age, is now available at all of your booksellers. It released on June 18. I'm thrilled to welcome to the show Bob Brody, the author. Bob, welcome to Authors on the Air.
I'm happy to join you, Pam.
You know, very rarely does anyone say anything to me in email that motivates me to immediately want to speak to them. And I have to say, you sure know how to write an opening line. Maybe that's because you're a media strategist and an essayist and you've done tons of articles everywhere, but you definitely caught my attention. Congratulations on that. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great, and I'm all the happier for talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, before the show, when we were in the green room, we were kind of talking a little bit about kids and all and how they kind of force you into adulthood. But I love the fact that while you became this responsible parent, you know, husband and parent, you didn't forget the things that are important in life. And so tell us a little bit, please, about why and how you wrote Playing Catch with Strangers.
Well, it sort of happened by accident. I decided about 12 years ago to turn my hand to writing personal essays. It was just practical. It was something that was manageable. It was a lot easier, I thought, and more advisable than trying a novel or trying anything so ambitious as a book. And so I just went piece by piece and was writing about my mother and my experiences with her and being raised by a mother who is profoundly deaf, and about my father eventually, who also was deaf and born deaf. And I just was writing about my life. And after 12 years of writing these essays, I had more than 100 essays and realized that without intending to, I had written piecemeal what amounted to a memoir of sorts. And so I approached an agent and put together a proposal and then a secured interest from a publisher, and that's how it came together. It was really just kind of piece by piece, and I realized that it amounted to something that felt substantial enough, and so and then with the publisher I worked on putting it all together so that it felt more like a memoir than like a collection of essays. And that's really how it happened. I'd never intended necessarily to write a memoir, but I guess I just got headed in that direction and happened sort of organically.
Sometimes that's the best way, though, don't you think? You were very honest about everything in the book, and the book is delightful. There are some places that it's quite wistful, but other places that it's just downright funny, and I really enjoyed it. There are so many things that have happened to make up your life it's interesting to me that we kind of view ourselves as just ordinary people, yet when you chronicle the things that have happened to you, you really have had an extraordinary life. You talk a lot about your parents who were deaf. You also talked about something that happened to you after you moved into your first apartment. Would you talk about that a little bit, please, and how that changed you, or did it?
Yes. I was living in New Jersey. I had just graduated from college, and my father said to me that perhaps I could be looking for a job a little bit harder than I was. And indeed, he was right. I was being pretty listless about it. I was going for interviews when the whim struck me. And he was about to start charging me rent for living at home. And at the time, of course, I bitterly resented it. But in retrospect, I was glad that he did that because he convinced me that it indeed was time for me to get out on my own. And so I got an apartment in Manhattan, on the Lower East Side on East 7th Street, a one-bedroom studio apartment. And 5 weeks after I moved into Manhattan from the suburbs of New Jersey, relatively crime-free suburbs of New Jersey, I was coming home one day from picking up the Sunday New York Times and was at the front of my apartment, and a mugger came up to me with a big knife, stuck it in my face, said, "Open the door, let me in your apartment." And when I refused to, he stuck the knife in my chest. And so that was my introduction to living in New York City. My first thought was, welcome to New York, Bob. And, that was a pivotal incident, but luckily I survived. Luckily, the person who stabbed me, the drug addict, it turns out, who stabbed me was not homicidal, was not out for blood. He was out for property, and so he took my property. He even took the time to tell me that I would heal okay and that the wound was not serious. And I know that he deliberately stabbed me only superficially because he wanted to get into the apartment, and thank goodness for that. He just wanted to scare me, and he did. He absolutely succeeded. I'd never been stabbed in the chest before, and so I decided at that moment to take him very seriously, to take him at his word, and to let him into my apartment.
Sure. Wow. What a baptism by fire. You're welcome to New York. I hope that the road from there was less rocky, or at least less violent. But then you talk about your wife, Elvira, is it Elvira or Elvira? I'm not sure how you
Elvira
pronounce it, because she's an Italian now.
It depends on which country you're in, I think. In Italy, I gather that it's Elvira, but in the United States, we say Elvira.
So, but you almost blew your first date with her.
Yes. It's an incident I have yet in my own mind to completely live down. We went out on a blind date. I was at home, and a friend I had made who lived in the apartment building came by and told me that his girlfriend had her girlfriend coming over, and would I like to meet her and perhaps go out for dinner with her. And so I met her and was completely taken with her and quite nervous around her. And we went to Little Italy, to a restaurant on Hester Street called Puglia, which is still there. And I drank a little more red wine than I was accustomed to. And afterwards, I asked Elvira whether she would like to come up to my apartment. And she said no, and I said something that I've regretted for my entire life. It catches me up short even to bring it up now, all these years later, considering how absolutely obnoxious it was. And make no mistake, it was obnoxious. I just said, what are you, a lesbian or something? And I think, and believe me, my shame is for that remark is never going to go away.
Bob, I have to tell you right now, you have to learn to laugh at yourself. You have no idea how many times women have heard that. It really, you know, anymore these days we laugh at it. And probably it's a good thing you didn't say it in modern times, and your wife was probably too lovely and too sophisticated and too much of a lady to say anything. But, you know, somebody would have said something really snarky back to you had it happened now. Forgive yourself. If she loves you, you're fine.
I appreciate
and I have
your saying
laugh
that.
About
she has,
that.
She has since forgiven me, and it's, of course, one of the reasons I married her in the first place is that she has a good heart, and that, to me, was the ultimate criterion for getting married. And luckily she said to me something to the effect that you have no idea what you're saying. You've had a little too much wine. I'm just going to let it pass and I'm going to go home and we'll talk tomorrow.
Aww. You know,
and that
she
was our, and
one
that
of
was
those
our
people who was a kicker and, you know, could have rearranged your life substantially. So I think that she was very generous with you, even though I will laugh at this story later on. I want to tell you, Nick, forgive yourself. You know, life goes on. It's a cute story though. It's a cute story, Bob. It really is. You know, I love the title of your book, Playing Catch with Strangers. It's an unusual title, but actually, you do like to play catch with strangers, don't you? You like to be around kids.
I do. I will have a catch with anybody. I mean, I went to a park here in Queens the other day, and I saw a father and son playing baseball, and there were a couple of guys joining them, and I just asked to join in. And so we played baseball for a while, and I was pitching, and I played left field, and then I hit the ball for a while. And the kid got involved, and I was pitching to him, and he was starting to feel a little bit more confident as he went along. I was lucky enough to be in Italy last December visiting my daughter, who lives there now, and there was a kid kicking a soccer ball around, and he was kicking it around all by himself. He was just kicking it against a wall and keeping it in the air and practicing his left foot and practicing his right foot. And I just signaled to him that I'd be happy to join him. And so there we were in this small, ancient hillside town in southern Italy, having a catch with each other with a soccer ball. And I later found out his name. And so that was that. So I will have a catch with anybody. And the title of the book came from an experience in Connecticut. Our family was on vacation. We were at a motel and we were poolside on a hot summer day, and a kid was having a catch in the pool with his mother. I think they were throwing around a tennis ball, and after a while the mother got tired, and so the kid was left in the pool by himself. He was maybe 10 years old, and he started just throwing the ball up to himself, and I thought, well, no reason he should have to do that, especially if somebody's around to have a catch with. So I just signaled to him that I would be happy to join him. His mother said it was okay, and I got in the pool, and we had a catch. And when I got out, I turned to my wife, and I said, you know, I really think I could have a catch with strangers. I could play catch with strangers for the rest of my life. And
interesting.
And she turned to me and said, yes, I believe you could. And
Bob,
and it's true.
What is it? What is it about playing catch? What is it that's so iconic about that scene? And it's so important to Americana, because that's what it feels like to me. I remember my dad, who was so good with the neighborhood kids that kids would come on the door and say, can Mr. Joe come out and play? And I had three younger brothers. And so he would always go. He taught all the kids in the neighborhood how to swim. We were the only ones with a built-in swimming pool. They played baseball on the front lawn. He taught them how to played football and basketball, but baseball was his thing. What is it about playing catch that is so special?
I have given that some thought, and I really want to dig in on the research one of these days, because I know that people have written about it and perhaps given it even more thought than I have. But to my mind, it's just sort of a primal act. I mean, it's a form of conversation that takes place between people. And if it's between a parent and a child, that makes it all the more richer. And of course, it often happens between fathers and sons, although I've had catches with my daughter too. I just think it's a dialogue. It's a way of making a connection. It's a conversation. And it's also an expression of cooperation. It's a way of saying, okay, if you throw the ball to me, throw it back to you. And then we'll just keep going. And if you throw it to the right, then I'll move over to my left and I'll catch it. Then I'll try to catch it. So I'll try to throw it so you can catch it. And you'll try to throw it so I can catch it. And it's just it's just kind of the universe staying in harmony, if that doesn't sound too grandiose.
It doesn't. It actually sounds right. It is a conversation. One that I did not have with my father, because I had three younger brothers and he did not know what to do with his firstborn, who turned out to be a girl. He later actually, our thing was he took me to learn how to ride horses, and that became our thing. But not for lack of trying. I would say, you know, stomp my feet and say, I want to play baseball. I want to play. I just wanted to do something with my dad. And I guess you and I are of the same generation. And I guess at that time it was, you know, awkward for him. It may have been very awkward for him, but it was a conversation. It was a conversation he had with all the kids in the neighborhood. Interesting. You have some incredible blurbs for this book. A quote, playing catch with strangers is a gem filled with insights, wit, pithy observations, common sense, and neighborly decency. We're going to get back to that. A delight and a thought-provoking memoir said by Dan Rather, former CBS TV anchor. How is it that you and Mr. Rather know each other and that he came to write this blurb for you?
Oh, it's quite by chance. I wrote a book 25 years ago, and it happened shortly. I had the good fortune to interview Dan Rather for a magazine article I was doing. And after I interviewed him for the magazine article, I took the liberty of reaching out to him and to say, I've written a book. Would you mind taking a look at it? Would you be interested perhaps in contributing some sort of a testimonial? It was a book called Edge Against Cancer. It was about 12 athletes who had developed cancer and then came back to compete again, a baseball player, a football player, a soccer player, a golfer,
wow,
all kinds of athletes. And he was kind enough to do so, and he composed this beautiful testimonial for which I will always be grateful. And then all these years passed, and I thought, is it conceivable that lightning could strike twice? Could Dan Rather possibly be gracious enough to offer me a testimonial for my second book 25 years later? And sure enough, he was. And so he wrote the blurb that you just read.
You have a who's who of well-known people. Bob Guccione, who is the former editor of Spin. You have someone, Nicholas Pileggi, who wrote Goodfellas. You have, oh my gosh, so many great people here who have written about this book. Do you think that it speaks to both our childhood and our parenthood that people were interested in not only reading but blurbing for you?
I wish I could say I knew why. It's, to me, I just feel fortunate that people came through. And I also feel fortunate, I have to tell you, that my agent told me that it was important to have testimonials. I went to her interested just in doing this book, and had no idea that I was going to need to collect testimonials, but she said it was important in order to get a publisher interested. And so I went around asking people I knew, asking pretty much everybody I knew if they would help out, if they would refer me to somebody, recommend somebody. And so I was lucky enough to get these endorsements from people, and I'm grateful for it.
It is true that in the industry, when you're, for all intents and purposes, this is a debut novel since your last one was 25 years ago. Although I have to tell you, if the book is still in print, I'd love to read that one too, the first book, because it sounds fascinating to me. I'm always interested in how people overcome whatever difficulty is put in their way. I want to talk a little bit about your background and who you are and what you do. You are an essayist at heart, but you are also a media strategist. So would you tell us what that means, please, and what does that entail in your day-to-day life? And then I want to talk to you about your essays.
Okay, very good. I went into public relations full-time 26 years ago. I realized I had to make a better living than I was making then as a writer, especially with my son and our daughter on board for the ride. I needed to have health insurance covered and all those practicalities. And so I started working for public relations agencies, first a small agency, then a larger agency, and now a much larger agency, one of the largest in the world, Weber Shandwick. And what I do and have done for most of the last 26 years is focus on a very particular task, which is really figuring out what story the client has to tell. And how to tell it, and whom to tell it to, and also how to tell it at the right time. For me, the end all and be all is what we now call earned media, as opposed to say sponsored content, meaning that it's the merit that gets you in the door, and if you have a good enough story, then a newspaper or a TV station or a radio program will pay attention to you. And so my job, by and large, is figuring out how to win favorable attention
your client. Sure.
Exactly.
That makes sense to me. How much has social media changed your world?
It's changed it a lot, to the point where I'm now getting sort of compulsive and pathological to perhaps a disturbing degree. I'm really checking my Facebook page a little bit more than is probably healthy for me, just to see what sort of responses are coming in and how many likes I have lately. And I guess it just points to an insecurity that refuses to go away, it's changing everything. It's changing the media. It's changing public relations. It's changing our personal lives. I personally have to tell you that, especially of late, I'm really excited about everything that happens on Facebook. I find that I'm just making connections with people I went to high school with, people I went to. People I work with many years ago, and also as an author now, again, I'm connecting with readers in a way that I imagine was all but impossible years ago. I mean, people are now telling me, I ordered your book on Amazon. I just read it the other day. I thought it was terrific.
Right.
And for me to get to hear this from people, I mean, what could possibly be more exciting than that? Then that's what
it is. It's an immediate response that you normally did not have. Even, actually, how would you know unless you talk to a bookseller who said, oh, guess what, I sold 10 books this week, and you would be thrilled to hear that. Now you have immediate feedback, and I don't know if the immediacy of everything is good. But I do know in your situation, I would imagine it's exceptionally rewarding, particularly when someone says, I bought your book and I've enjoyed it. On the other hand, social media can, as it can be used for good, it can also be used for evil. And once, you know, a story gets out there in social media, it's very hard to dissuade someone this story is incorrect, that what were stated as facts were not actually facts. And it's hard to kind of quash that. It kind of is reminds me of in the newspaper business, which is what I went to school for. I did not end up going into journalism, but reminds me. But I read voraciously everything, anything with print I would read, and it reminds me if a story was incorrect, and the next day they'd have it, you know, on the third or fourth or fifth page in a box down on the left-hand corner that says, oh, correction, you know, we made a mistake, or and whatever it happened to be. Social media is more immediate than that, and it's hard to pull back a story or a thought or, you know, whatever is on there. So it's a balance, don't you think?
I do. I mean, let's face it, a lot of good stuff happens on social media, and a lot of stuff that we could probably do without happens on social media. I suppose I'm a little Pollyannish about it. I mean, first of all, I never post anything political. It's just a preference of mine. I talk about politics with my wife and with my friends and with my family, but I just decide to keep it off Facebook. As far as I'm concerned, we have enough of it. Plenty of other people are weighing in. And so I know how I feel, and I have no interest in getting enmeshed with it. And it's not for lack of civic interest. Certainly, I'm as patriotic as your next American, but I just feel that just as people have a right to express their opinions, I have a right to keep mine to myself.
Absolutely.
So, but
it's a slippery slope too, because you can't divide up your readers and your potential customers by political parties. So it's unwise, in my humble opinion, just the same way as I don't start my show by saying, can you please tell me who you support politically? I'm not the least bit interested. I don't care. It's not my business. I remember when in the olden days, when probably, and you'll remember this too, when our parents would go to the voting booth, they literally pulled a curtain closed, and so what went on behind the closed curtain stayed behind the closed curtain, and people did not talk about their political choices. And I kind of miss that time, to be honest with you. While I don't deny anybody the right and the ability, and certainly, you know, they can do whatever they want to say what they want, to me, if you are you're a small business person, as am I. I don't want to alienate anyone. You know, my business is my business. Is that kind of right? Did I say that right?
I know exactly what you're saying, and in my case, the same is true. I mean, the fact is, in my role as a public relations professional, I represent different organizations, and so I think it's incumbent on me to try to stay neutral as far as expressing an opinion in public is concerned.
Absolutely.
I mean, our company our organization represents all kinds of companies, and so I just figure it's better for me to try to be discreet, to try to be circumspect, and that's my inclination anyway. I mean, I would just as soon I have to admit out of it, and so I have. I mean, I see Facebook largely as I just see the potential to do good, and so that's what I'm personally trying to do through Facebook, and I appreciate other people who feel the same.
I will say that for listeners out there, you really should go to Bob's page. His page is adorable, and he has a lot of really good, wonderful, interesting, insightful, and inspirational memes. And you will also see pictures of his family. His daughter is absolutely gorgeous. She's a chef in southern Italy, but she's probably one of the most photogenic creatures I've ever seen in my life. You have a very handsome son. Your family is lovely, and it's a joy. It's a joy to read your page. So thank you for that from a reader's standpoint. I'd like to take a moment and invite listeners to call in if you're interested and say hello to Bob. The number is 347-633-9609. Bob, you write an awful lot of essays for a lot of places, The Atlantic, The WAPO, Wall Street Journal, and dozens of other major newspapers and magazines. You've contributed to New York Times. As a matter of fact, I just did a story on you that I posted on my Facebook page, on New York Daily News, Newsday, and Esquire, GQ, Reader's Digest, and so on and so on and so on. Tell me how and why you write essays, and how does this mesh with your life as a publicist, as a PR man, a media strategist?
I write essays. I write personal essays because I tend to take life pretty personally, and so.
Good for you.
When I have an idea, about something, and it's about a subject that matters to me, I sort of operate on the principle that it might matter to other people too, that if I'm writing about my mother and my, let's just say, my estrangement from my mother and then eventual reunion with her and reconciliation with her after 10 years, that might be something that other people have gone through too. Indeed, I highly suspect that it is something that a lot of people go through without necessarily being public about it. When I write about my father and about how I really came to appreciate him as fully as I should only after he died, I think that may also be something that people can recognize themselves in. And it's not that I do it for that purpose. I just feel that I am like other people. And so what I'm going through, other people must be certainly be going through as well, and so what can I say? My life is interesting to me, and I figure that if it's interesting to me, it might be interesting to others, and so so I've written particularly in the last 12 years or so, I've written a lot of essays, and it's a joy to do the essays, but it's also tough because as writers who do this know, sometimes you have to submit a piece to 10 different places before somebody finally says yes, and that's happened to me any number of times, and it's humbling to this day when that happens, and it continues to happen. That's just how it is. But when finally an editor says yes and then showcases your work and people respond well to it, then that's what you want, and especially when people say, "Oh yes, I read your piece, and it said something that I've tried to crystallize in my own mind, but was unable to, and so you said it for me, and I know exactly how you feel, and that's how I feel too." That's
interesting.
There
is a lot of commonality between us. I think we have more in common than we have that separates us, and perhaps your essays highlight that. Yes,
Exactly. And I guess
you have a beautiful
I guess come
blog,
to think of it,
by
it's
way,
kind of a,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
No. Because I want to bring up your blog too. We have such a limited amount of time. I'm going to have you come back. That's all there is to it. You have a beautiful blog called letterstomykids.org. Why is it a .org, and why Letters to My Kids?
Oh, well, .org, I have no idea exactly how that happened. I suppose I'll leave that to the digital experts. Maybe it's just happenstance. But Letters to My Kids came about because I decided in 2008 that after doing all the writing that I'd done for newspapers and magazines and others, that I should finally once and for all, write something for my children, exclusively for my children, something about the life I've lived, the life we've lived together, just so they can maybe understand me and understand me as a father, and also see just how much I adore them. And so I spent a year writing these little vignettes, little memories of from my life and times I spent with my kids, and then handed them handwritten journals as a Christmas present. And then I did it again in 2009, and it amounted to a fair amount of material, and I realized that maybe it would be worth going public with this. Maybe if other people saw what I had done with my kids, they would want to do the same with their kids. And maybe this idea that should preserve personal family history in writing for the benefit of future generations, maybe that would be an idea that people would be interested in and others might be inspired to follow suit. So I started a blog that was based on these journals and took the what I had written to my kids, and with their permission, of course, started posting the pieces.
What a beautiful testimonial of your love of from a parent to a child. My parents' parents were immigrants, and so I only met one, my maternal grandfather. I did not know the other grandparents, and how I wished I had a chronicle or a written history of my family. I think it's a wonderful thing, and I think it's something that, you know, in the South, you would see things like that written in family Bibles or by families gathering together, generations and generations of families gathering together on porches and telling stories and so on, and passing an oral history on. You've kind of done it one better, and you've chronicled it in writing, which is obviously your forte. So how delightful, and I think it's wonderful. I wish more parents would do that. I want to kind of turn the conversation a little bit. We're running out of time. I want to spend the next hour talking to you. I know that's impossible. Let me ask you a few things about yourself, if you don't mind.
Of course.
Are you a reader as much as you are a writer?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
What do you
like
to read?
I love to read. I've always loved to read. I wish I could read more than I do. I will read pretty much anything and everything. I certainly like my magazines. I'm trying to stick with reading books as much as I possibly can. Yes, the answer
what
is yes.
What books did you read? What books did you read?
To be a writer without being a reader.
If you were in the bookstore, you're in the fiction or the nonfiction section, which would you be?
Oh, you're talking about my current book? It would definitely be in the nonfiction section. It's a memoir, so.
Ah, and you like autobiographies, memoirs, things like that, do you?
I have come around to that. I've read some really good ones over the years, and they've given me all kinds of good ideas. Yes, I've felt drawn to the form. I have tried twice to write novels, and I think that's all behind me now, perhaps for the best.
Well, you found your place, though, it sounds like. So let me ask you this. What kind of music do you like to listen to? You and I are generationally in the same place, but I'm curious about what kind of music you enjoy.
Yeah, I have to admit that I am generally stuck in time when it comes to music. I have either failed to evolve or refuse to evolve, or am just doing a poor job of adapting to changes.
Okay.
Certainly I have listened to contemporary music, and I've enjoyed some of the music that's happened through the 80s, the 90s, and now. But I have to tell you, for me, still the end-all, be-all is the music that formed me in the first place, and that was the music that I listened to largely in the mid 1960s and late 1960s
oh,
and early 1970s.
God, really?
Yeah. So, for me, the end all be all continues to be the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix.
Good. You're also a hard rocker guy. Good
yeah,
for
well,
you.
And also Miles Davis and other jazz greats. I like the blues. I certainly like B.B. King and so on. But I've just had this idea that it would be fun to do a book. I'm not going to do it, but I thought it would be fun to do a book called Unstuck or Getting Unstuck about somebody like me who was just kind of set in the 1960s and 70s when it comes to music and books, someone whose tastes were formed, and that's kind of that.
Well, if it's any consolation to you, I want you to know that Sir Paul McCartney turned 75 a couple days ago. So that's just to let you know. There you go. I want to ask you a few more things about you. What would your friends be surprised to learn about you?
Oh, I think I probably indulged in full disclosure with all my friends. It's hard to imagine that they would be surprised by all that much about me. I mean, we've not only talked a lot, but they've read my stuff, and so I've kind of come clean. I mean, I really have very very few secrets left.
What would we be surprised to learn about you?
Well, I mean, okay, as long as you're asking.
Yes,
and
I am.
I know this sounds sort of flip, but I can impersonate an elephant blaring.
Is this going to blow the speakers in the studio?
I don't know, and I'm hesitant to do it for fear of being thought obnoxious, but
Anyway. Be obnoxious. You have to have an obnoxious outlet, and if that's it, an elephant sound, what can you do? I'm ready. Go.
Okay, I'm going to try it. Here
do
we
it.
Go.
Not oh, boy. It was lovely. Did you spit on yourself?
It was not quite as high pitched as I would have liked. It's a while since I've done it, and now I've thoroughly disgraced myself on radio.
Are your cheeks pink thinking about that? And don't worry, because we turned off the video before you did that. Okay, so you don't have to worry. Tell me what's next for you. Are you interested in putting together another book, Bob?
I am. I'm very interested. It's really high on my list. I have in mind three other books I would like very much to do. And
how wonderful.
And you touched on Letters to My Kids. Truth is, what I would like to do is for my next project is reinvent that as a book. I think it lends itself to that. I did have in the blog, not only the pieces I wrote, but I had 80 columns from guests. I had 80 guest columnists, parents themselves, mothers and fathers who wrote pieces for Mother's Day, for Father's Day, for Thanksgiving, for Valentine's Day, who were writing letters to their own kids about how they met their spouses and about why they were grateful for their kids. And I also wrote some pieces about how I went about doing these letters and how others might do it. So I was trying to be a little how-to in case people felt reluctant about it, in case people said, well, I'm not a writer, he's a writer, so it's easy for him. I just wanted to try to convey the idea that anybody can do it, and that that's another reason why perhaps you should. And then there was another element, which was that people throughout history have written letters to their children. Presidents have written letters
have.
To their people who were on
yes.
death row wrote letters to their children. So there's
yeah.
this vast history. And so I guess I'm under the impression that it could make a good book. That would be ideally my next book and the first of three books altogether.
I hope that you do that. As we talked about before the show started, you know, I spoke to you a little bit about my daughter and how important she is to me. Even though I used to birth and no babies, so I know nothing about birth and no babies, but she is still my daughter, and we have that strong bond, and so it's a wonderful thing. Bob Brody, media strategist, author, wry observer of life, parent, husband, you have been a delight. I hope that you will come back and join me again. It's been so much fun. Will you please tell everybody where they can find you on the web and on Facebook?
Sure. My website is called playingcatchwithstrangers.com. And my Facebook page, I guess, is readily accessible to all. So I invite anybody who wants to connect with me to reach out and do so. And, Pam, I've loved talking with you, and I would love to talk with you again.
Please come back. Please. And as a matter of fact, let me throw this out there. Come back and choose somebody that you would like to interview and come back and have an in-conversation interview on the show, will you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that would be wonderful.
Okay. I would love that. I would enjoy that so much. Bob Brody, who is author to Play and Catch with Strangers, he is an essayist. He is a media specialist, a media strategist, PR guy, and he's got a fabulous blog. Go look on my website, on my Facebook page for Pam Stack. And then Facebook, you know, my page is open. Anybody can post there. Whoever gives me a comment about their favorite part of this interview, I'm going to send you a copy of Bob's book. In the meantime, Bob Brody, thank you so much for being with me. I hope you have a great weekend. And hello to your wonderful wife and two children. Thank you so much. Please come back.
Thank you, Pam. I'll come back anytime you say.
Thank you. Have a great night. And that's our show for tonight, folks. Thank you for being with me so much. And thank you, Mom and Dad, for making all my dreams come true. Good night, folks.